Right. This is just so big for me. I have Kimmy, right?
Yes, that is right.
And I'm just almost blessed to be, virtually in her presence because she's someone that I find very inspiring, straight to the point, in the things that she says, and very deep and sort of soul searching, soul everything. So today I just wanted to talk a bit about one of your videos actually that I saw on YouTube that just blew me away. And people are going to find out why in this video, especially topics that I personally find very, very needed, very much needed in our society. And one of the topics you explored was about forgiveness, and I just want to talk about that today. But before I do, hi, how are you? Tell us about you. Why are you speaking? How is it, just generally, I just want to know, a bit about you, what you're about.
Totally. Thank you so much for having me. I'm very, very excited to get into this and talk to you too. I love your content on Instagram. I'm very much inspired by you as well. A little bit about myself. I moved to the States in 2013 when I was 19. So I've been here for about 8 years. And before that, I studied in South Africa throughout my high school years. That had a profound impact on my perspectives around race. And prior to that, I lived in Tanzania and Uganda as well. It's sort of where I grew up as a child. And so all of that experience in Africa has, it was very hard to fully commit myself to woke ideology because there were so many things in the back of my mind that I was like, I know different and I know better than this. Like, this isn't for me, and I don't feel at peace about it, even though I persisted in a sort of woke mentality for like about 6 years. So, that because I had that at the back of my mind, like Nelson Mandela and what Desmond Tutu did, and living, my parents and their parents living under Idi Amin, it's just so much that's in my history for me to ignore it and be like, oh, let me just adopt this new ideology that some academics made up, So, yeah, I'm an artist now. I paint, I work in the music industry, and so I'm just like using my voice where I can.
I've seen your work and like, wow, I saw it on your feed and I was like, did she actually paint this? So yeah, you guys have to check her out because it's gold, you know what you do. Now,
Thank
I
you.
want you to speak a bit about wokeness because maybe this is something I don't think I okay, let me talk about it. So you mentioned in your video that you were woke for a very long time. Or for a very long time, and you didn't know how it's possible for someone to never have been woke. Was that what you mentioned? And
Yes.
I was like, I've never been woke. That's me. because people always ask me, what made you change your mind? What made you think this way? And I always say, look, I have always thought this way. I've always been an outcast. I've always been that had that kind of individualistic mindset in terms of whenever there is a mainstream thing, my first sort of my first reaction is no, let me step back. Let me look at it and see what it's really about before I make a decision. So, in all honesty, I've never really felt woke. I mean, even when the trends come out, I'm always late on them, So I've never really followed the wokeness. So how has it been for you? Like, what, I mean, obviously you're unwoke now or whatever, but how was that trend? How was it transitioning, if that makes sense? And what was the main driver of you getting out of that woke mob mentality?
Yeah, totally. So regarding the, there needs to be a little bit of wokeness. The reason I say that is I actually said it in the video, but I cut it out because my video is actually way longer. And I'm like, I need to cut this so down to like a, palatable size. I was mainly talking about people who were alive in like the civil rights era, who who didn't really care about like what's going on in the South. And obviously, like, this is not our generation, but I think to a degree, a little bit of social consciousness and compassion is, I honestly believe we all kind of trend towards that. And that's what gets people tuned into wokeness, is because they take that heart yearn for compassion, but then little do they know is that there's an avenue that perverts that. So it's like a perversion of compassion. And so what I meant was, like, you know, whenever there's a movement to sort of look into it to see what the truth is, that's that little bit of wokeness that I'm talking about. I think that is most people, but there are people who I never thought existed, but there are people who really don't know anything about the world, and they're not conscious at all about any injustice, whether that's like providing water in Africa. That's that little bit of wokeness that I mean. But academics tend to pervert that and just like take that ounce of compassion and lead it down a road. And then for me, the thing that got me drawn into wokeness, it's very strange, but it's let me try my best to explain this. It's like, I came to the United States in 2013.
Mm-hmm.
In that period, my experience of the United States was contrasted to my experience in South Africa, where the idea of integration from a formerly segregated country was fresh. And so race was always at the forefront, but it wasn't a burden to talk about, because there was a blanket of compassion and forgiveness that existed, thanks to like Nelson Mandela and people like that. So when I came here, I was astounded to see how little racism there really was compared to my experience in South Africa, because they were fresh. So I was very happy to be here. I was shocked that people wave to you on the street. I was shocked that even, like, you know, people who work at the store will ask you, like, how's it going? Like, mm-hmm. simple things like that. People might not understand that that's not common in other places. Like, that could be a whole other video conversation, right? So when I went to college maybe a year and a half later, like 2014, 2015, I was beginning to get taught the way the world is. And because mm-hmm. I'm like, I'm paying for this education, it's expensive, I really do believe my professors are telling me the truth. Like, I really do believe they have a greater understanding of the world. And so they're imparting that to me out of their duty. Little did I know that the lens that they were feeding me was already skewed by postmodernism. And so they teach you, like, you know, power structures exist. Like, this is the truth. Like, there is a hegemony or a hegemony, however you pronounce it. Like, this is just the way the world is. So because you're just submitting to their authority, you take that as, okay, I will now integrate this into my worldview. Because I don't want, I'm young and they're old, they're mature, they have a doctorate, they're a PhD, whatever. And then eventually I felt that darkness creep in, where you start to analyze the world through your new tools. You have all these tools, like you can interpret someone's microaggressions, for example. That's something I talk about in the video. And so I started seeing these small interactions, day-to-day interactions, whereas I was like, oh, wow, someone is like very friendly and they're saying hi. Now it's like, oh, now I'm thinking about the negative. Oh, they didn't open the door for me. That's because I'm Black and, you know, like, it's like a white straight man or whatever. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, I go to a church community group and I'm like, oh, everyone's looking at me funny because I'm the one Black person. And so you go home with all that burden and you think this is just how you're supposed to live as a Black person. But then it's too much of a weight to bear eventually. So, yeah, that's kind of how I got teased into that.
Amazing. I want to ask you a few questions. So sorry, I'm putting you on the spot, but
that's okay.
So, okay. You grew up in South Africa, mm-hmm. And a few other places. And then you came to America and you felt this kind of, I would say, distorted way that you were shown in terms of how to relate to the world, you know, your upbringing, your family, parents, how did they explain or how did they express how the world was? I'm trying to gauge what influenced you more, if they were similar to your professors, if they were completely different, which what then caused you to actually take on what the professors and so on were, and the university and college institutions were passing on to you?
That's a really good question. My parents were actually very, they didn't make excuses. Like, they're very much so, like, we actually very rarely talked about how we as Black people are oppressed in society. It's very much, it was like almost like we rarely talked about that. I remember I would go to the Hector Peterson Museum with my dad, and he would take a lot of guests who would visit South Africa to this museum where they basically display the struggle of African students who didn't want to be taught in Afrikaans. And there was like a shootout, and this boy called Hector Peterson died, unfortunately. And there, it was just like a simple protest of like, we are, you know, we're native Africans. We don't need this like Dutch language. This is oppressive. One of very many struggles under apartheid. And, you know, for my dad, that was enough to be like, this is what it was like in South Africa. And this is enough education you need to understand that you're valuable. Like, don't let any white person oppress you. My mom, when it came to being a woman in like business, she's a manager. She's an airline manager and has been for many airlines for a while. She refused to explain an excuse for how it was hard for her. She's literally like, I can't, like, I don't want to tell you that because that's going to like taint your worldview, right? She's just like, do you, like, just be you, be confident in yourself, like, read. My father would always have us reading every day. He would always provide material for us to read that he's kind of looked through. And so all of that, I feel like they were more so of like the clear thinkers who I was like, wait, my parents did A, B, C, D, and they never made excuses. And they were in like white environments. They met in the UK, actually. They both went to the University of Essex, I think it's called.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they experienced that, you know, race, what we would call racism in the 80s, which I think was not as great as we have it now, right? So if they couldn't make excuses, like, that was something at the back of my mind where I was like, why am I now weak if they did all of that back in the day? So yeah, if I hope that answers the question.
It really did. And I guess to explore that more. So maybe that's what kind of allowed you to easily transition out of wokeness, because you always felt that there was something not right. But then yeah. My question as well is, how come that darkness, or how did it happen that you did sort of leave the university college lectures with that different kind of lens of seeing the world, in terms of seeing the microaggressions now, when you had that foundation of parents who, yes, they recognize the struggles and things like that, but like you mentioned, they didn't pass that to you. So where was that kind of crossroads or link, or, you know, if that makes
sense? That makes a lot of sense. I would have to say, because I came to the States kind of solo and my parents are back home, there was a sort of, I don't know if weaning is the right word, probably not the right term to use, but I sort of had to figure out my own identity and my own life. And to me, it was like a wolf in sheep's clothing. Like, to me, I just thought it was an innocent like understanding of the world. Like, I couldn't pick apart all the problems with it. And then there's peer pressure as well, where you don't want to be the one Black person who's saying, like, I don't know about this. Like, I don't think this is great. You know, like, yeah. It's kind of awkward. And and I'm sure both of us can relate to that. So the peer pressure, the fear of kind of saying like, this is wrong, kind of pointing out the emperor has no clothes. It's like, that takes a while to break out of. And you're just so blinded by just everyone is walking in this. So obviously there has to be something good about it, right? Because everyone's agreeing. So that's sort of what pulled me away from that foundation.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Amazing. And that's why I always say, and I always emphasize the importance, you know, of parenting, because, you know, like you said, there's nothing wrong in necessarily being involved in the wokeness, but it's being drawn away and having your identity dictated by whoever. I think that's where the issue lies, and people not understanding why they believe in something or thinking something. For example, which I want to get into next, people thinking that they're oppressed, but they don't weigh up, you know, the facts and weigh up even their own personal life. And it's really annoying. I think there's something you mentioned, and you mentioned, for example, your mom, she's a manager, and you mentioned she didn't go on about all the struggles she went through. And I'm sure there were barriers mm-hmm. and struggles. I'm sure of that. But it's so great that you emphasize what she's doing now. And the reason I'm mentioning that, because I have had debates where people will tell me, well, yeah, they're a doctor now. Yeah, they're a this now in terms of a Black person, but they went through this, or but. And it's like, no, it's not a but. The emphasis should be on who they are now, what they are now, what they have achieved now. It's like almost they sidetrack the achievement, the journey. It's like it's nothing, and it mm-hmm. offends me, because I don't know if you've had this happen to you before, but even when I'm speaking and people say, well, you're just being used, or you're not really thinking for yourself, it's like, if you don't respect me or my opinion, respect my journey, respect the struggles I've had. Don't just sideline it to, well, you're just gaslighting, or whatever other words that they want to say. When we don't necessarily talk about all the hardships and struggles, it's not that we are denying or deniers. It's because we value who we are now, what we have now, more than that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny. I was reading, I don't even know how it came. I think it was just a random read, but it's that guy, Stephen Hawking. It's mm-hmm. unrelated, but it's funny because that's what made me link it to this oppression and things like that. Obviously, you know about his disability. Mm-hmm. And apparently he founded, or his board founded, like a charity to help people that had a similar condition to him. Mm-hmm. And apparently he wasn't involved in it as much. And he used to get a lot of backlash, not so much, I guess, within his own little circles of, he doesn't care about people with the same disability as him, and so on and so forth. And I read a commentary saying it's not that he didn't care, but he didn't want that to be the definer of him, that this is, you know. And he didn't want his life just for that. And mm-hmm. I understand two things about it. Of course, if you're in a certain situation, you can sympathize, which means you can help better those similar to you. But I do understand people that don't want to be labeled or just associated with that. His goal was to open all minds to help all kinds of people, not just people in similar situations to him. And so on and so forth. So it's just random, but I just feel people are so obsessed with, what can I do for my people, and what can Black people do for me, and things like that. But this world is so vast and, you know, diverse. You don't need to just stick in one thing. Or anyway, now I'm rambling.
But I hear you though. I hear you completely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, wow, there's something you mentioned, and I know some people are going to pick up on it, so I want to talk about it. So you mentioned, because I relate to this as well, but I want to hear it from you. You mentioned when you came here, you noticed that there was little racism in comparison to where you were, you know, where you grew up. Yeah. Now, some people will hear that and think, well, no, actually, America has, you know, more racism than anywhere in the world. When I tried to give my opinion on the subject, I remember on Clubhouse, there was a room called, are you on Clubhouse, by the way?
No, I'm not. Not no. Right now.
You should. I'm never on it, but when I'm on it, it's quite interesting. And there was a room called, How Do We Solve Racism? That was it. How do we solve racism? Okay. It was a good conversation until I joined. I noticed it was all Americans until I joined. And then they said, well, you can't talk because you're British. And I said, well, if the title is How to Solve Racism in America, I hear you. I still feel I can intellectually input somehow into the conversation, but I can hear you. But America or Black Americans don't have ownership of racism. It's just a weird thing to me. Why would you want to claim that as, I don't know, I mean, they can keep it and I don't, it's, you know, but it's just a weird thing, this holding on to it. Like, you know, I'm sure you've had experiences like this where people try to exclude you from the conversation, though you've lived in all these, you can talk about it, and yet you're not valid in the conversation because you're not a certain group. So what do you think about all this? What's your experience? And
that's very well said and very well put. To me, it's like, we can't, I mean, unless you also, whoever is accusing me has also lived in South Africa for 7 years, like, we're totally on a different, like, we're on different levels, because you can't even relate to what I'm saying, even in a knowledgeable sense. Like, you can't just read about it and be like, okay, I understand South African racism. No, first you go there, you experience it for a few years, and then you come back and tell me that I don't have a right to say anything. Because it's just, it's ridiculous. And when we talk about measuring Blackness or taking ownership to Blackness, I honestly, and this is my honest opinion, the standard would be the ability to speak a Bantu language, the ability to have lived in a Bantu nation or tribe for a long enough time, you know, the surrender to African philosophy and African ideology. Mm-hmm. But most people who claim that you're not Black enough, the standards are from a culture in which there is a distance from the African root and lineage. So it's like, what Blackness are you talking about? Because in Africa, it's a whole other standard, and you know, Africa is the origin of Blackness. Like, we all know this, it's not a mystery. So when someone tells me I'm less Black, I'm like, no, you're less Black. Like mm-hmm. this is not even a debate at this point. Mm-hmm. It's just, if you're measuring someone who is ethnically Asian or maybe ethnically Middle Eastern, you measure it by the language, by the assimilation into that culture, by their traditions, for example, someone mm-hmm. who's traditionally Korean, for example. But when it comes to Blackness, there is, it's all over the place. It's like, no, it's American Black, no, it's UK Blackness, no, it's South African Blackness. It's like, can we just accept that the spectrum is too broad to define? And we are not going to play that game, because I will never tell someone that, oh, you don't speak Swahili, so like, I'm going to condemn you for your lack of Blackness. Mm-hmm. But if we're being, you know, standard with all of our judgments across the board, that in reality would be it. I could tell you that you're less Black than me because you don't speak a Bantu language, right? So whenever someone tells me that, inside I laugh. Like, it's just like, I'm sorry. Like, I actually feel sorry for you. And I did have an experience where I was in, because you asked, you know, have I had that experience? I have had a very visceral experience that really kind of popped me out of my long journey out of wokeness. This was kind of like the it moment. And I was in a church group, actually, on racial reconciliation. It sounds very much like your story of Clubhouse, right? and people were talking about how, you know, we were separated into a white group and a Black group, where Black people would discuss Black things.
Wow.
I, thinking that everyone knows Nelson Mandela and knows like his story, it's like, and it's a church too, I said, yeah, we should forgive. Like, I think the next step right now is to forgive. This is after George Floyd and everything. And people were just silent. And they were just like, they didn't know how to take that, because there was this moment of, yeah, I know that's the Christian thing to do, but also, how dare you say that? And for like 1 minute, then one of the elders spoke up and was like, no, I can't forgive, so angrily. And I was just like, whoa, like, it's just, first of all, it's a suggestion. But second of all, as an elder in a church, your primary instinct should be tending towards Jesus-like character. So even if you didn't agree with what I'm saying, I didn't appreciate the fact that there was such a pushback against that, you know, such a basic tenet of Christianity. And so that's when I knew that almost there was something wrong.
Sorry, almost it's the foundation.
It really is the foundation.
Forgiveness, there is no Christianity. That's interesting.
Sister. sister girl. Like, honestly, yeah, 100%. Without forgiveness, like, the whole concept of justice and, you know, it's all rooted in that. And then to just reject it on the basis of skin color was very, that's when I really knew this is really bad if it gets that far. By this, I mean, like, critical race theory and critical social justice. But yeah, so that's, yeah, that's my stance on, like, you know,
Black. Wow. I'm literally speechless. Like, I'm literally really, you can see how much race is such a powerful, and I don't mean powerful in a positive way, just it's such a big deal. Like, over skin color, you know, people deny even their own basic core ideologies. Yeah, so in terms of racism, though, because I want to get to the forgiveness part, because I'm always on the side of forgiveness, just because no one is perfect, exactly. You know, and for me, forgiveness empowers the person who forgives, in my opinion.
Exactly.
And people misunderstand forgiveness. They see forgiveness as weakness and as a pass to what a person did to them. I don't see it like that. I see when you hold a grudge, when you have bitterness, it only harms you. Mm-hmm. It's just as simple as that. If I hate you, you can go on living your life, doing your thing, and I'm carrying that weight and I'm suffering, and it's an energy, it's a spirit. You can't touch it, you can't feel it, it's holding you back. So a lot of, let's say people, let's be more specific, because I've spoken to these people. No one believes me, but I've spoken to, and I'm sure you have, like, Black people that just can't forgive. And I will say, when I talk about forgiveness, I'm not even talking about the day-to-day, let's say, interpersonal racism. I'm talking about they don't forgive what the white man did to them. You know, I'm talking about slavery. I'm talking about things that didn't happen to them. They are carrying that. And I don't get that. You know, if you can talk a bit about the racism that you've experienced, you know, if you want to go there, and how you can even talk about forgiveness on an interpersonal level and also just generally, you know.
Yeah, it's so multifaceted, because, you know, even in the context of race, there's so many scenarios that go down that you can't actually, you know, looking back at all the things that I was like, it's because of race, it's because of race, it's because of race. I actually look back, I'm like, I don't really think I can blame it all on racism, because you're dealing with so many dynamics in a given scenario. For example, if I walk into a room and say there are like five people standing there, right? And because I immediately see there are five white people standing there, I'm like, I pull my face. And so I'm mad and I'm angry and I'm already defensive before anything's ever started. How do you think those people are going to treat me if I come into a space and I'm already defensive? I will crack just like that if you say anything wrong. They're obviously going to have a negative reaction in turn, because I have already judged them to be horrible people. And so how do I interpret their interpretation of my negativity? I say, oh, they had a racist tendency. So it's such a cyclical thing where once you start, you kind of you're like the locus of racism, because you're always expecting it. So you're always attracting it. And so it's why I think it's so important to begin to pull race into your forgiveness philosophy, however people approach it, is because you're creating the potential to create so many negative situations is so greater when you're holding on to so much hurt. So even if you are passionate about social justice, why wouldn't you first forgive so that you have peace and realize that people of the past, they can't do anything for you now. They're not going to come back and give you everything that they took. They're not going to come out of the grave and be like, oh, we're so sorry. Their descendants are, you can't trace their descendants. Like, it's impossible. Like, you're carrying a burden for no reason. There is no reason, because there's nothing that can be done, and it's unfortunate. Like, so the only thing you have to do is just cut that cord of debt and start from the beginning. And so how much more effective would you be if you weren't going into every scenario with pain? That for me was my starting point. I just don't want to feel that pain. But then once you embrace that, it's actually funny. Your interpretations of future events change, because now you're like happy and you have a happy demeanor and you're peaceful. So people see that peace and they're like nice to you. And so that cycle of positivity now becomes a thing where you're not really even experiencing quote unquote racism, because you're not coming into an atmosphere with so much pain, if that makes sense.
Makes perfect sense. And it's like, you summed it up. What is in you, you attract, you know? Scientifically, there's something called the RAS system in your brain. I forgot the full name, but I read about it briefly. And it's a part of your brain that stores information based on what you focus on. Because obviously we know our brain is a computer, right? So it doesn't have time to process every bit of information all the time. That's too much. So what it does is, for example, you know, the whole cliche, if you break up with your boyfriend, whatever, and you think about him, then you see his face everywhere kind of thing. Or if you're craving ice cream, you see ice cream, that kind of thing. It's because it's your brain filtering that information and then drawing you closer to get that, if that makes sense. Just, it's called RAS. I'm not scientific. Look, anyone watching can look it up. But what we think about is what we attract. I'm a big believer of this. Before I cared about psychology and all the, I knew this. I experienced this. I lived this. Many people who know me don't know that I had a wild and teenage years. I was a wild teenager. I was a wild girl. I was one of those girls in fights, in the parties. When I had my last Zoom talk, my friend was like, you? I was like, yeah, me. I was really crazy. I was really crazy. And I remember there was a time that I went up to a group of like 8 girls and I challenged them, and weirdly enough, they backed down, and it was just literally me and a little friend I had with me. And because they saw that bravery, they were actually looking for me for a while to actually try and stab me up. This is what I heard. Once they find me, they will stab me. So just little things like that. I was always attracting that trouble, because that's what was in me. I wanted trouble, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah. And then,
when I decided to get out of that kind of silly lifestyle, whatever, just not to go too much into it, I didn't move cities. I didn't change my looks or anything. I saw the same people, and yet I wasn't encountering that trouble anymore with them. It's like I was almost invisible. So it's like what you focus on is what you attract, and people don't understand that. And that's why I always push back, especially with this topic of microaggression, which you touched on. We have to be careful with this, because even in the name, that's so dangerous for people, because you look for it. You know, many things that people class, in my opinion, that people class as microaggression, it's not microaggression. It could be a misunderstanding of cultures. And when I say misunderstanding, I don't mean in a negative way. We don't know everything. And we are such a global society now. I'm in the UK, in London, you're in Los Angeles. You've lived how many places? I've lived in a few. We have so much backgrounds and ideas in us, you know? So of course there will always be this kind of mini clash. It's not racism. It's not ill-intended. And I feel people, like you mentioned, are taking on so much pain unnecessarily. You have two people, two Black women. You have me and you have another girl, for example. And let's say a white woman says, oh, can I touch your hair? Which I don't think anyone should be touching anyone's hair anyway. But how do we interpret that? Okay, in the short term, you can even say, actually, that's inappropriate, whatever. But it's this blanket, oh, you see white women, this overgeneralized, this is how it is, this is how all, you know, I don't, I can never get that, you know?
Yeah.
And even things about where you're from and things like that, it's like, well, what is wrong with that really and truly if it's not mm-hmm. said with ill intent? So
yeah,
I definitely do agree. And there's something you mentioned in the video as well, or I think I saw it on your Instagram, is that if people actually speak to people who have gone through, like, I mean, brutal racism,
mm-hmm.
and it's when we read accounts of those who have actually gone through brutal real racism, 99% of the time, look at their mindsets, though.
Exactly.
I don't see hate. Yes. I don't see. So I don't get the misaligned that from a microaggression of someone saying, can I touch your hair? That's come enough on. For you to hate a whole race, think they hate you. Whereas someone who was born in, as a slave, who witnessed his family being slave, who was literally humiliated legally. No, it wasn't illegal. It was legally fine for them to do that. And yet they can become professors, entrepreneurs, you know. So, you know.
Absolutely. Sis, I hear you. Yeah, I mean, just in response to that, it definitely makes me concerned that just the sort of, you know, the sort of basic thought process of like, do you want to listen to someone who sits at a desk and they're a professor and all they do is just think about race, or do you want to listen to the people who have like dealt with the racists? You know, like, to me it's so easy. It's like, oh yeah, obviously, like, do you want to talk about space to someone who sits and theorizes about space, or you want to talk to an astronaut? Like, come on, like, what are we doing here? So like you said, 99%. I even have this book by Desmond Tutu, No Future Without Forgiveness.
Nice.
And look at how thick this is. For someone to go through all these things, talk to the apartheid presidents and leaders, right? Mm-hmm. And out of all of that, at the end of it all, he decides that it is important for me to say that there is no future without forgiveness. Wow. That alone should wake up so many people who think, oh, touching my hair is, you know, oh my God, I could never forgive you for that. Like that, come on, guys. Like, just respect those who have done the most dangerous things that none of us could even fathom. Just respect their struggle, please, because they've been through way worse than touching him, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Powerful. So what is your, how easy is it, I guess, or how difficult? What are the tools then?
Mm.
You know, because it's easy to say forgive, I guess. Mm-hmm. But to some people who have as well, let's say, experienced that racism, like yourself, because yes. I feel we have two kinds of people, in my opinion.
Mm. Or
three. We have those who've experienced that real, brutal, humiliating, overt racism. It's because you are Black. It's because you are Black. This is why I'm doing this negative thing to you.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have others who... It's not so overt, but maybe it's the microaggressions. Maybe it's the, I didn't get the job and I think it's because I'm Black. Then there's no proof, but they
right.
think you have that. And then you have those that never really faced racism, to be honest, but they're taking on that racism of the ancestors and their mm-hmm. past and George on people they don't know. For example, you have people crying. I always say this about young boys, whatever. You know, they're crying about George Floyd, for example, but they're not crying about their homie that was killed last, someone that they personally know. So they're more worried about this collectiveness and people that have been blown up by the media and things that are happening right next to them, they don't really care about because there's no white man element to that, if that makes Ooh. Sense. So you have these three kind of groups. So I guess for all three, forgiveness somehow needs to come in. But how can that happen? Really, how can that practically happen? Isn't that?
I hear you. How can forgiveness happen? So I honestly, because of my faith, that makes that process way easier Because there's actually a story in the Bible about a man who had a debt of, it was like 10,000 something. I forget what the actual currency was, but he had a huge debt and he needed desperate forgiveness for it because he couldn't pay back. I think it was a landlord or something of that nature. Let's imagine it's a landlord and you have a back debt through COVID. You've just been like, I can't pay rent. It's COVID. Like, I've not had a job and I now owe like $100,000. And you have this huge debt over your head. And because it's so impossible to let go of, you beg the landlord, please, like, I don't want to be homeless. Please just like, please forgive this. We've gone through this horrible pandemic. And your landlord is like, okay, fair and square, like cuts off the debt and you're now back to zero. And then you see someone on the street who owed you like 20 bucks. And you're like, oh my gosh, why is she drinking Starbucks and she knows she owes me $20? Like, come on, man. And so you end up kind of beating up that person. If you're talking about wild days, mm-hmm. like, I hate you. You're so rude. How dare you like not pay me back in time and then run away from me? And that's, it's hypocritical. And it's a reflection of your appreciation for what your landlord did for you. Because you don't actually think that your debt was that big and you've quickly forgotten how big your debt was. And now you're turning to someone and who has a way smaller debt in comparison and enacting out your fury over them. So that helps me understand, knowing that I have been paid, like I have been forgiven of something that I can't even fathom having to pay back. That allows that $20 in comparison to look like nothing, right? Mm-hmm. So that's my Christian perspective. Second is, a prayer. I literally have to come to the presence of God mm-hmm. and bring forth this person in my mind. If there's someone who did me wrong and it's still nagging and it's like, da, 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 da. This person said this, this person did that. I'm like, Lord, would you just help me right now to forgive this person? And I really believe that he gives me the grace to remember my huge debt and then the grace to forgive them of their small debt. So then after that, I go through four things. I say, I forgive you to this person. I just say it out loud to myself. I don't have to go to them. I just say it to myself. I say, I forgive you. I love you. I bless you. And I release you. And that for me has been like just a pattern with anything that comes back to the surface at this point. It wasn't always like that, but it's sort of a new thing for me. Mm-hmm. I just quickly say those things. And for me, I think for saying I forgive you is easy, but saying I love you, that one is really, really tough. That one, you feel like your heart is going to explode and you're going to vomit. It's like, mm-hmm. I love you. And, you know, I'm just bless them. Like, I bless you and I release you. Like, I release whatever you've done to me. You're not going to live in my head rent-free. Like, I release you. Go do your thing. And I'm going to move on and do my thing. So that's my mental process for forgiveness.
That's so powerful. And I think the releasing part for me, even the word release, I love it. It's just like, it's mm-hmm. it's the most important. We have to release, and release comes when you don't see future events or you don't judge future events based on that past event that you were suffering from yeah. in the first place. You have to really let it go. And many black, white, you know, I speak a lot about black people, but this could be anyone, and this could be in relation to anything. You know, they have to let go of what really hurts them for them, mm-hmm. you know. And you know, you spoke about the Christian spiritual side, and I think that's the foundation. And I also think in terms of the collective, how we can forgive, let's say mm-hmm. I think there also has to be healing. And if I'm going to yes. go back quickly to this talk of blackness, I always say there's a lot of blame on, let's talk about slavery, on the white man. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of blame and pinning it on them as the root and the source mm-hmm. of why it happened. Mm-hmm. And I feel that obviously that's not the case. In terms of what history shows and the complicity of Black people. And I feel that many Black people know this, especially those who live in Black in America and those who live in the UK. Deep down, their soul knows the complicity of their own people. And that's why many times they don't want to associate themselves with Africans. That's why they say that you're a different kind of Black, because they know deep down it's almost hard to face themselves. Because that's I'm not saying that it was their fault, but it's harder when you realize that you somehow contributed to your own pain. That's harder. It's a harder, more complex way to be, you know, and that's why it's so So, you know, they has to, without that, Kimmy, honestly, without this, it's almost gonna be impossible for them to get to that point that you've mentioned, even of saying, okay, now I forgive. You know, I went through a lot, but I did a lot, and I had so many people that hurt me that was so hard to forgive them, and this affected every part of my life, studies, relationships with people, with family, affected. And I'm not saying I caused it, but I had to go deep within me and forgive myself. And when I say forgive myself, it doesn't mean I caused it, but forgive myself for allowing me to have that much pain and whatever in terms of the situation. And I think as Black people, if we do want to go on about being so collective and collective, we can't have it both ways. Either we are collective and we all come together like a big family, African people, you know, whatever, and say, okay, this is the situation, let's hash it out, let's talk, let's move on. Or we are not a collective as Black people, and you have ADOS, Black immigrants, and so on and so forth, and let's see how we can figure out the issues then separately, but we can't have it both ways. I always just quickly before we, and I don't want to keep you, I'm sure you don't mind. I'm loving this conversation anyway.
Me too. I don't mind at all.
But I always liken it to let's say you live in a foster home. I don't really like to say foster home, but let's just say your family gave you up. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of the times, if that foster child is growing up in pain, many of the times, if you notice, they have more hate or grudge or problems with the real parents, because it's like, well, why did you give me up? Why didn't you love me? And it's just being offloaded to the foster parents, but it's not really. It's the hurt is to the real parents. And the truth is that African people of Africa were completely, I've read a lot of this, I've not read it all, but it's a lot of deep stuff. I read once that apparently British diplomats were sent to Benin, one of their main ports of slavery, to stop slavery twice, and they said no because it was good for their economy. So with that complicity, the truth is that there's a lot of deep-seated subconscious hate or animosity towards that, and they need to deal with that. They need to talk about that, not accepting or taking that guilt, because that's not the case, but just facing it. And I don't think we can move forward without that root being pulled out.
Absolutely, Ada. Actually, I think we've gone to a very deep and real place that I feel like even listeners who are tuning into this for the wrong reasons to point out and make fun, even those people right now are being hit with a realization. I just know that, you know, because the funny thing is the Lord was kind of revealing that to me too, that exact thing that you expressed, maybe in a slightly, like, to add on to the fact that slavery was a booming business for Africans back in the day. And we also learned the East African equivalent, where they were trading slaves to across the Indian Ocean into like India, into the Arab lands. It was a norm. And it wasn't, you know, the consciousness of evil it goes both ways. Like, no one really, they knew what they're doing is wrong, but no one really wanted to stop the money or the income. But there's also the fact that, you know, with all the invasions that came in from other lands, from Germany, from Belgium, the Dutch people, the British, there is an unforgiveness, like you said, with the parents, that is attached to the hurt for Africans not being able to have defended themselves at that time. And I don't think a lot of people have gone that deep. Like, you opened that door, right? To be like, I don't think I realize that I'm holding unforgiveness because I feel so much hurt that my ancestors didn't protect me enough. They didn't defend themselves. They were not facing the type of opposition that the people from other lands were facing, so they didn't have the weapons to defend themselves. And they did win. There were some battles that were won by Africans. Like, the battles weren't just like, you know, overtaken by the Europeans or whatever. But I think we also need to forgive our ancestors where they didn't protect us enough, where they were focused on herding. They were focused on warding off bears from attacking their herds, but they weren't warding off, you know, foreign armies and stuff like that. And I think it would be helpful for any of your listeners to check out Guns, Germs, and Steel by Jared Diamond. It talks a lot about colonialization and what drove the movements of cultures and things like that, to just get a better understanding of that. But yes, the forgiveness is not just limited to forgive white people. It's not like white people were solely responsible for the way things went. It was way more complicated than that. And yes, our ancestors are a part of that pain, but there's nothing we can't go back. We can't fix it. We can thank God for like William Wilberforce. We can thank God for Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln and Martin Luther King Jr. and Nelson Mandela, and be grateful for their struggle, but we can't go back in time and undo that. But the best way is to let go of that pain, to acknowledge it, to go where it hurts to go, and then to let go of that pain. So thank you.
Exactly. No, thank you. And I think that's the basis of all of it. You know, I think that's what's going to bring things more together. And without that, we are just chasing the wind, as they say, you know. Yeah. And it's unfortunate, but I think the most important thing is realizing that it's about now as well. You know, the focus is now. We can't, like you said, we can't get anything back, you know, we can't change anything, but the focus is now. Where do we go from here? And we've come a long way, a huge long way, especially in the countries that we are living in. In many other countries, maybe it's not, we can't say that yet, but for sure in the UK and the US, we can say that we have come a long way. And, you know, there's still a way to go, but what's happening if we're not doing things right is that we're going to become complicit in that, in the lack of progress as well, in a sense, because just a simple example of, you know, let's say policing, we have issues with policing in the Black community. Well, if we don't go about things in the right way, then we attract, like we talked about attracting earlier, you can attract that as well, you know, let's say the issues with policing. Whereas if you have a right mindset, a right attitude, the right energy, then when the bad things do happen, when the bad incidents do happen, then it's clear that it's a bad incident. But nowadays, all I'm seeing blown up in the media is bad incidents, but somehow the victim was complicit or contributed or attracted that. So we can't, it can't work like that. You know, we have, I love Judge Judy. Oh my gosh, people are gonna, I love her. I don't care, I love her. And there's one thing that she said, if you're gonna come to court, you have to come with clean hands. Your hands have to be clean. So there could have been no wrongdoing at all on your part, and that's how you would get true justice. But you can't come to court and then you've done something that contributed to those circumstances in the first place. And I think many times what's being shown in the media anyway, I'm not saying it's the case, but what the ones that have been highlighted in the media, many of the these victims of Black people in question didn't have clean hands. So are we trying to, is this can't be the standard for our community. We can't be excused. The aim should have clean hands so that when the bad incidents happen, we know clearly, it's clear. There's no other dynamics complex. It's so clear that is there's no justification. There's no justification anyway for any wrong, any act of racism. Or, there's no justification. But at least let's be clean on that.
Doing, yeah, absolutely. Bringing our best foot forward. And yeah, I couldn't agree more. You said that perfectly.
Oh, wow. That was deep. I loved it. I loved every second. That was so powerful. That blessed me.
That blessed me too. Like, I feel it in my stomach. I'm like, ooh, like literally my hands, my face is like burning.
Yeah.
I definitely feel this is going to set a lot of people free. Yeah. Because the truth sets people free, you know? And I'm so grateful for you for using your voice for not being ashamed or afraid or, you know, holding back certain topics or ideas, because it's just, there's so much that needs to be addressed, you know, beyond policing. Like, we also need to talk about character. We need to talk about what is this going to look like in the long term if we have two different moral standards for two different groups based on skin color. It's like, we have to say those things. We have to talk about it. I have to talk about the ancestors, slavery, not contribute to like this censorship culture. So thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you. Please keep speaking, doing what you're doing. Where can people find you? Where can people find your art? You have to check out the art. Oh,
thank you. Thank you so much. You can find my art at KIMIKATITI.com. That's KimiKatiti.com. And I have links to my music, my art. You can purchase prints in my shop. Videos are there as well. Everything is on there. And social media, my Instagram handle is at KIMIKATITI, Kimi Katiti.
Wonderful. And your YouTube, you don't want to talk about your amazing YouTube?
Yeah, find me on YouTube as well. The link to my YouTube is also on my website. Funny enough, I have a different URL for my YouTube because of my old artist name, so I don't even want to get into that. It's so hard. Nyonyozi Music, because that was, Nyonyozi is one of my middle names, and it's so hard for people to pronounce in America. So I've had it for like 9 years, you know. So yeah, if you want to check out my YouTube, I would say go to my website and then click YouTube and it should direct you there.
Yeah. And I'll drop the links as well in this video.
Absolutely. So, thank you.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure. And we have to go deeper. I think we need to go deeper. But I think with time, I think now these conversations are happening. That's the most important thing. Let them come out and then we can start. You know, we can start plucking as a collective. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Yay, this is great.